fasten your seatbelts. Let's see here. Proceed with all deliberate speed today. Stage four. That's the latency stage. There's a reason why it's called the latency stage. Because initially Freud didn't think it was a stage at all. He thought that that period of time was a period of time in which we went into a kind of developmental dormancy where not much was happening. Because of the contrast and the tremendous difference between what happened in stage one, stage two, and stage three, and what happened in the fourth stage. Freud's colleagues persuaded him to take a closer look at what was happening in that fourth stage. It's much longer than the first three. Covers most of, and you may want to jot this down, covers most of middle childhood, the grammar school years. From entrance to school, being ushered into the society of, or subculture of childhood, being physically separated from home and parents. For in most instances, a minimum of 6 hours a day. That time gets longer and longer the longer the kid is in school. Ushered into this new environment, learning to deal with substitute adult authority figures who are not parents but teachers. Freudian psychoanalytic theory suggests that what happens is the child takes what he or she has acquired. Through the process of sex role identification with the same sex parent, to school with them and tries it out. What meets with acceptance and approval by their peers, they keep, they retain, in terms of the accoutrements and characteristics of someone of their gender. And here we're talking about masculinity or femininity. What doesn't meet with the approval of their peers, according to Freud's theory, is eliminated. And it is replaced with new things that kids acquire from their peers. So in Freud's model, what happens is that the process of identification shifts from parents to peers. Freud's theory also suggests that during this stage of development, we see an almost exclusive preference for association with same age, same sex schoolmates. The subjective psychological discomfort created by the Oedipus of the Electra complex in the preceding stage causes a child, when they enter into this stage, to demonstrate an aversion to heterosexual interest, curiosity, inquisitiveness, and attraction. Since the relationships with parents is de-intensified because of the entrance into school, the tension and conflict that was generated in the home during that period of time when the child was in the midst of that emotional triangle subsides. Listen carefully. What says Freud? That Oedipus complex, or that electric complex that the child experienced before entering the world of school, does not, I repeat, does not disappear. It simply goes beneath the conscious level of awareness. Subrosa, beneath the conscious level of awareness. It is either repressed or suppressed out of conscious awareness on the part of the child. There is an aversion to heterosexual attraction, interest, curiosity, inquisitiveness. Next, says Freud, this process of acquiring the traits and characters. Now, let me just reframe this. According to Freud's theory, when kids are physically separated from home for those kinds of periods of time during the day, the opportunities to have their emotional and social needs met are dependent upon the degree to which the child is accepted by their peers. Parents aren't there to address those needs. Teachers don't have time to meet the needs of 30 or 31 or 32 or 27 kids in the classroom individually in terms of their psychological and emotional needs. So, what happens is kids turn to each other. And kids find one another great sources of support, comfort, etc. The degree to which a child's, listen carefully, the degree to which a child's emotional and psychological needs are met by his peers is dependent upon the degree to which that kid is accepted by his or her peers. The degree to which they are accepted by their peers is determined by the degree to which they resemble and exhibit the characteristics of the informal leaders of the peer group subculture that they are associating with. All of that fosters taking on bits and pieces and chunks of the gender identity of other children and incorporating it into that basic foundation they developed at home. This whole process just hums right along, says Freud, through most of middle childhood until finally the child gets to that last chunk of childhood that's often referred to as later childhood. Sometimes it's called pre-adolescent development. To be technically correct, it's really something called pubescence, pre-pubertal development. It's a period of time that lasts anywhere from 12 to 18 months prior to the onset of puberty, during which kids undergo significant changes. And without waxing too heavily in terms of neuroendocrinology, the chief gland of the endocrine system, the endocrine gland system that we have, is something called the pituitary gland. It's located at the base of the brain. And for most, from the time a child is born through most of early and middle childhood, it is the front part of the pituitary gland, the anterior portion, that produces a growth hormone that's called pituitrin. It's responsible for the tremendous growth and change and development, physically, muscularly, skeletally, that kids go through over the course of their developmental years. About 18 months prior to the onset of puberty, the function of that pituitary gland changes, as you will see when we go back and deal with Chapter 2, the biological basis for behavior, not just the functioning of the brain, but also the endocrine system. The back portion of the pituitary gland now begins to produce very high quantities of another hormone, and that hormone is called gonadotropin. Gonadotropin is a hormone that radically increases the activity of the sex glands of the body in order to prepare that child to make the transition from sexual immaturity to achieving sexual reproductive capacity. So it activates the functioning of the ovaries and the testes in the child. So males start now to produce much larger quantities of testosterone, females start to produce much larger quantities of estrogen, and the concomitant result is that there are two kinds of sexual characteristics that begin to develop. It's no longer possible for that child to continue to deny, suppress, or repress their sexuality. Because every time they look in the mirror, they see themselves changing. First kind of changes that occur, primary sexual characteristics, the internal development of the reproductive system. That's the first thing. The second thing is the one that Freud was particularly interested in, and that's the development of secondary sexual characteristics, the observable, visible changes that kids go through. Changes in the musculature, the skeletal structure of the male, the development of facial and bodily hair, the development of breasts in the female, all kinds of visible external changes start to occur so that the child, every time they look in the mirror, they see themselves changing and maturing. they can no longer avoid their sexuality. When that awareness returns, back comes the Oedipus complex in the male child. Back comes the Electra complex in the female child. Once again, they start to become interested in heterosexuality. They begin to find people of the opposite sex attractive. There is a return of heterosexual interest, curiosity, inquisitiveness. When those complexes come back, says Freud, the last time the child experienced them, they were expressed within the family, causing a great deal of turmoil emotionally for the child. Conflict, fear of aggression of the same-sex parent, or rejection by the same-sex parent, etc. This time when they come back, says Freud, those feelings are redirected outside the family toward what Freud calls substitute love objects. That's when they begin to find people of the opposite sex attractive. And according to Freud's theory, and opinions differ on this, but according to Freud's theory, this is what happened. If a male child, during the course of his earlier developmental years, had a close, warm, affectionate, healthy, caring relationship with his mother, characterized by genuine intimacy and closeness with her, when he starts to find females attractive, he will be unconsciously attracted primarily to females who possess many of the characteristics of his mother. If that relationship was faulty, defective, dysfunctional, then when that male starts to find females attractive, he will be most attracted to females who are the opposite of his mother. The same is true for girls. A close, warm, caring, affectionate relationship with her dad during her early developmental years will cause that female to be unconsciously attracted to males who possess many of the traits, qualities, and characteristics of her father. If the relationship was faulty or defective or emotionally impoverished with that father figure, when she starts to find guys attractive, she will be most attracted to the opposite of the way her father was, if that relationship was faulty or defective.
But you said the early childhood, like around what time did that stop? Like, if the relationship was really good from the ages 1 to 6, from birth to about 6, the relationship changed, like the emotional.
At 6, the personality is fully formed, and for the most part, they're through and out the other end of that critical time when it's most important to have a good relationship.
So, if the relationship was to change, the young man would still probably look for women.
A nurturant, affectionate, somebody who possessed many of the caring qualities and characteristics of the mother during that early developmental process. Now, this stage ends with the onset of puberty, that transition from sexual immaturity to sexual maturity, even though after puberty occurs, there is generally, though not always, a 12 to 18 month period of sterility as a result of the immaturity of the reproductive system. And that again varies from child to child based on their rate, their tempo, their pace of development. Nutrition and all kinds of other factors, heredity, all kinds of things figure in. Puberty marks the beginning of the fifth and final stage. Buckle up, here we go. This fifth and final stage is unique among Freud's psychosexual stages of development. It is unique because In one sense, nothing new happens in this stage. In another sense, there's a lot that happens in this stage, though not necessarily new. Freud's theory is often called a recapitulation theory. This analogy works for most students, so let's use it here. Freud's view of the development of personality is like making a small snowball, going over to the edge of a very steep hill and taking the snowball and pushing it over to the edge. As that snowball starts to roll down the hill, it picks up more and more snow. Twigs, leaves, blades of grass, all kinds of debris, whatever it passes through is picked up and becomes part of it. So that by the time it gets to the bottom of the hill and comes to rest at the bottom of the hill, it is a collage, or it's made up of bits and pieces and fragments of every single thing that it's been through in its path down that hill. That's what happens in stage five. According to Freud, it's in stage five that the snowball comes to rest at the bottom of the hill. And here's the developmental task for the fifth and final stage in Freud. The developmental task is to find a way of harmoniously integrating all of the traits, qualities, and characteristics developed in each of the four preceding stages in such a way, integrated in such a way, that we are relatively free of disabling internal conflicts. So to find a way of finding the compatibility, if you will, the complementarity of our own unique oral, anal, phallic, and latent characteristics. And put it, so this is the stage where we need to get it all together in such a way that we're not in constant conflict with ourselves because of the traits developed in the previous four stages. Yes?
Can one trait in, let's say, one stage conflict with another trait?
Of course.
In another stage? Okay.
Absolutely. That doesn't seem like that hard a job. However, no sooner does Freud tell us what the developmental task is for this stage than he adds this addendum. None of us have a perfect mother and a perfect father and a perfect child. We all have problems and difficulties going through our developmental years. We all collect our share of bumps and bruises and scrapes and dings in the course of going through that developmental process. And it doesn't just happen physically, it also happens psychologically and emotionally. And Freud says this, if there are problems, if there are difficulties, he says some of us have greater difficulty getting through some of those stages more so than others. And he says that if that's the case, the greater the degree of difficulty we have in getting through any one stage, the longer we tend to remain in that stage and try to resolve those problems or difficulties before we move on. The longer we remain in any one stage, says Freud, the more the characteristics of that particular stage become a permanent, deeply ingrained, dominant part of our mature personality structure. The concept we're talking about in psychoanalytic theory is referred to as fixation. To be fixated means to experience a slowing down, a stunting, or a complete stoppage or arrestation of development in a particular psychosexual stage because of the problems encountered. If, in fact, fixation occurs, and to a greater or lesser degree, it occurs for all of us, to some degree in various stages, it leads to what Roy calls regression. Yes? Yep, a slowing down, an arrestation, a stunting of development in a particular stage. It can be a complete stoppage of development in a particular stage and an inability to move on. Any stage. If it happens in a stage, Freud says what happens is that the developing individual tends to remain in that stage longer than normal. and tries to persist in having its normal, healthy developmental needs met in that stage. The longer we remain in that stage, the more the characteristics of that stage become a permanent, dominant part of our mature personality structure. Freud tells us that fixation can occur for three reasons. They're listed on the outline that I gave you. I have listed them for you in the order of frequency with which they occur. The most prevalent and most common of the causes for fixation, the most likely to occur, says Freud, and this is consistent with Freud's theory of motivation, Freud says, deprivation. If our normal healthy needs, this one, if our normal healthy needs are not adequately met in a particular stage, you should have had this one right next to you all along that we've been talking about this, and you can just check these things off as we go through them, make sure we've covered all the bases. A child comes into this world today born as a result of an unwanted pregnancy. The woman already has five children. She needs another kid like she needs another hole in her head. Lo and behold, she discovers she's pregnant because of her moral convictions and because of her religious background. She is unwilling to terminate that pregnancy via an abortion, so she decides to carry that pregnancy to term, and as fate would have it, she delivers a normal, healthy baby at the end of 9 months. But because of the feelings of resentment that she has toward the reasons why that child was conceived, when that baby comes into this world, instead of responding to that little kid with patience and tender loving care and affection and nurturance, she responds to that baby with indifference, neglect, rejection, and at times, occasional abuse. There is no way in hell, if that's the case, that that little infant's going to be able to establish the kind of close, intimate relationship with that adult caregiver that Freud says is critical for the development of a normal ego, for normal, healthy development in that oral stage. So that kid is going to remain in that oral stage much longer than normal and persist in trying to have its normal, healthy developmental needs met. Freud talks about this as perseveration, to persevere in trying to have those needs met. It's not going to happen, but the kid is going to try. When ultimately the child reaches the point where they move on to stage two, without having, as Freud calls it, resolved inadequate resolution of the oral stage, now the child goes into the anal stage of development, still carrying with it excess baggage and a lot of unmet needs from stage one, so now the kid can't give his undivided attention to what's supposed to happen in stage two. That means there are going to be some problems and difficulties associated there, because the child is still only given partial attention to the developmental task for the second stage, because it's still working on the ones that weren't met from stage one. That means when the kid now gets to stage three, it's going to bring with it unmet needs from stage one and stage two into stage three. This is what's called the domino effect in Freud's theory. If anything goes wrong in one of those stages, it affects not only that stage, but all of the stages that follow it. You tip the dominoes and they all start to go. So it's cumulative. What happens in one of the stages spills over and affects the ones that follow it. Deprivation. Says Freud, the most common cause for fixation. Number two, second most common, oversatisfaction. Let's take the opposite case scenario. You've got two people who've always wanted to have children. They want to have a family and can't. After trying for several years, they start consulting physicians, reproductive specialists, doctor after doctor after doctor, medical bills up the wazoo. Finally, they reach somebody who has the brains to tell them, look, face reality. This is not going to happen for you. If it is truly important for you to have a family, perhaps one of the things you really ought to consider is adopting a child. There are lots of children who need a home. And it seems apparent from your history that this is not going to happen in your life. So they go to the appropriate agencies and they fill out mountains of paperwork and they apply to adopt a child, and as is often the case, no sooner is the paperwork done, lo and behold, she discovers she's pregnant. She's been pregnant before. She's had spontaneous abortions that Mother Nature brings on, has never been able to carry a pregnancy till term until now. This time, she carries that pregnancy to term and delivers a beautiful, healthy baby. Both of those two people know that in all probability, this is the only child they are ever going to have. And they go to great lengths. They are pampering, spoiling, overly indulgent, overly solicitous parents. That little baby wants for nothing. The best clothing, the best toys, whatever that child wants, it gets. That is the be-all and end-all. That kid becomes the virtual center of their universe. Now, Freud tells us, if you looked at that very first outline that I gave you, there are four reasons why we grow and develop psychologically. One of them, the second reason listed there, is frustration. We have to experience frustration in order to make a struggle to become more independent and self-sufficient. We have to get tired of being told, not now, I'm busy, you'll have to wait. Or I'll be with you in a minute, I'm taking care of your brother. Now here we've got a little kid that came into this world to parents who were delighted the child was there and want to do just everything for the child, who experiences no frustration at all. Well, hell, if you live in a utopian environment which all of your needs are anticipated and met by somebody, what the hell would make you want to move on and leave all that behind? Walk away from the gravy train, having to do for yourself. Just let them take care. Freud says, over-satisfaction, parental overindulgence. Parents have to learn their job is not to remove the obstacles from a child's path, but to teach the child how to get over them, around them, how to do for themselves. Not completely smooth out all the bumps, teach you how to navigate them. So Freud says that over-satisfaction of one's needs is the second most common cause for fixation. Less common than deprivation, but still more common than the last one, which is number three. The least common cause for fixation is the one that all of us know the most about, because we go to the movies. We watch television shows. We go to plays. We read novels. This is the stuff of which good plot lines are made. Thrillers. What's the third cause? Trauma. The experience of a traumatic event or a traumatic episode in a particular psychosexual stage of development. Listen very carefully. This is the least common cause for fixation, but according to Freud, it's the one that causes the most damage. The experience of a physical trauma, a psychological trauma, an emotional trauma during one of the psychosexual stages produces the most devastating results, and it is one that typically results in abnormal psychological functioning. It leads to abnormality, whether it be maladjusted behavior, personally or socially maladaptive behavior, or abnormal behavior. So, here's what Freud tells us. We've got three causes for fixation. What'd you expect? We're talking about Freud's theory, everything comes in threes. Three ways in which regression can manifest itself. Mild, moderate, and severe. What's mild? Freud says, in its mildest form, regression is responsible for all of our immaturity. Somebody you know, after they have a couple of drinks, they start acting like a 12-year-old. I was over in the academic learning center not long ago. I was waiting to see somebody over there. There was a student trying to work on a math problem. A tutor was unavailable at the time, so the student decided to give it their best shot. I don't know how many times they tried to solve the problem. But ultimately, in frustration, they reached down, tore the page out of their book, crumbled it up, and threw it across the room. That's mature behavior right now. So Freud says, in its mildest form, regression is responsible for our immaturity. In its moderate form, it is responsible for all of our maladjusted behavior, either personally or socially maladjusted function. In its severe form, it is responsible for all psychopathology or abnormal psychological functioning. Now, what do we mean by regression? Here it is. It is a tendency later on in life when we are exposed to stress, either severe stress or lower levels of stress, but over an extended period of time. There is a tendency, says Freud, for us to regress. And by regression, he means reverting back to a less mature, more childlike or childish pattern of functioning in order to cope with stress that we can't handle in a manner that's appropriate for somebody our age or our level of maturity, supposed maturity. Reverting back to a less mature, more childish or infantile pattern of functioning in order to cope with overwhelming stress that we can't handle in a way that's appropriate for someone our age or our level of maturity. Joseph, you have a question?
Yeah, I had the example you gave with the guy throwing the paper across the room, that's an example of moderate aggression. What would be an example of severe?
That wouldn't be moderate, that would be mild. That's immature.
That would be, okay, mild.
Maladaptive or maladjusted functioning would be moderate. Guy can't stand his boss. As a result of that, he hates going to work. Because of that, he arrives at work late every day. His boss chews him out. Every time the boss tells him to do something, he grumbles and complains. Takes his morning coffee break, which is supposed to be 15 minutes, and he drags it out to 30, 40, maybe 45 minutes. Goes to lunch, everybody else takes a half hour, 45 minutes, he comes back an hour later. Every task he's assigned, he bitches and moans about it. Comes time for somebody in his work group to be promoted to a supervisory position. He lets it be known he's interested in the job. He doesn't get the job. As a result of not getting the job, he tells everybody that he works with. The only reason why I didn't get that job, although I'm qualified, is because he's got it in for me. He doesn't like me. When in fact, he's the one that doesn't like the boss. And he fails to recognize the role that he has played in sabotaging his own opportunity for professional advancement. That's personal and social maladjustment. That's moderate. Moderate maladjustment, moderate regression. That's when people start saying, you know, that guy's really strange. He really ought to talk to somebody. I'm surprised they let him run around loose. Okay? That's maladjustment. Severe. Okay. Here we go. Abnormality. Freud says if, in fact, regression occurs and somebody regresses from supposedly stage 5, which is the stage of mature heterosexuality, and this person regresses back to where they begin to have problems either establishing or maintaining mature, meaningful, and mutually satisfying relationships with other people, either friends of the same gender or with members of the opposite sex, Freud would say that involves a regression to the latent state. Because that's where we first develop relationships with our peers of the same sex, and then toward the end of that stage is where we start to find people of the opposite sex attractive and get into establishing relationships with them. That's what Freud would call a personality disorder or a character disorder. If a person regresses and continues to regress back to the point where they begin to have concerns about their own sexuality, their own gender identity, where they begin to experience sexual dysfunction, disruption is in their normal sexual relationship with their partner. Concerns about their attractiveness and desirability to people of the opposite sex. Apprehensions and concerns about alternative sexual preferences. Freud says that's regression to the phallic stage, because that's the stage where we develop sexuality, gender identity, positive feelings about our masculinity and femininity. If we start to regress and go all the way back to where the person suddenly begins to manifest a lack of concern and interest in personal hygiene, cleanliness, they suddenly assume a disheveled appearance, or out of the blue, this person suddenly becomes really obsessive about their clothing and their dress and how they appear and so forth and so on. Or they may get to the point where they're very concerned with cleanliness, germs, and health, and all those kinds of issues. Neatness, cleanliness, tidiness, fear of going to public places for fear of contracting germs and getting ill, etc., etc. Freud would say that's a regression to the anal stage. Either anal retentive or anal expulsive. If a person regresses to the point where they begin to exhibit characteristics that cause people to wonder whether they are able to take care of their own needs, and a decision is made that person may represent, either through neglect or through just a lack of concern, a clear and present danger to themselves or others, and they're placed in a custodial environment where they're told when to bathe and when they're changed to change their clothes. They need help being fed. They're led from their room out into a television room, and they sit and stare blankly out the window or at a TV set regardless of what's on, where they begin to lose all contact with people outside, and they cut themselves off from relationships with other people. Freud says, hell, that's a regression to the oral stage. That's a return to infancy. And if a person becomes psychologically infantilized, Freud says, that's what we call mental illness. So please note, if the regression involves going back to the latency stage, it's a character or personality disorder. If it involves going back to either the anal or the phallic stage, that's what Freud called neurotic, neurosis, emotional disorders. If it involves going all the way back to the oral stage, that's psychosis, or what's typically referred to as mental illness. So the farther back we go, once we start to regress, if the person isn't removed from the situation that's producing the stress, or the stressful situation doesn't abate, it doesn't stop, that regression, says Freud, is going to continue, and that person is going to regress all the way back to that stage they had the greatest difficulty getting through in the first place, where the dominoes started to tip. And depending on how far back they go, that's what determines how severe their psychological adjustment problems are. The most severe, regression to the oral stage. Second, developing not mental disorders, but emotional disorders, and that's either stage two or stage three. Developing character or conduct or behavior or personality disorders, that's regressing to stage four. Question.
Can someone have multiple fixations?
Sure. Because anything that happens in this stage is going to cause fixations that come after it. The original one may be here. But once that happens, there are going to be fixation problems in all those stages that remain. Because that is going to spill over and interfere with development that should occur in the remaining stages. Question.
Okay. What stages do you get neurosis?
Two and three. Yes. Your question.
Oh.
Okay.
Also mental illness,
what is that? One. Psychosis, psychotic disorders, various forms of schizophrenia, etc.
One question. Will there always be, let's say that someone has multiple fixations, will one always be stronger than the other one, or are they all, can they, some be all equal?
I can't imagine a condition under which they would all be equal.
Okay. So always one.
Something's got to start the ball rolling.
And that's probably usually...
Okay. That's usually the most profound.
The first domino.
Freud says premier learning experiences, the first experiences we have, are the ones that set the tone. They're the most powerful ones, the most meaningful ones.
Now, how much...
Is this a compound question or is this another question?
I don't know.
Okay.
My question is, how much is that related to, let's say, maybe I'm going off topic, biological? Like, I heard some people that are depressed or with depression, bipolar, there's a biological chemical imbalance. Is that, maybe I'm misinformed, but is that developed over time or?
No. You tell me, does the biological cause the psychological symptoms or does developing the disorder and the psychological symptoms cause the biological changes to occur? We don't really know.
Okay.
We don't have answers to those questions. What we do know is there are usually biological, psychological, and social and interpersonal factors that contribute to all of it.
That's nature versus
nature. And it's unrealistic to say it's this or that or that. No. More often than not, it's a combination of factors. So there may be a hereditary predisposition, but if the person isn't exposed to situations that will exacerbate that predisposition and cause it to occur, it's not going to happen. You may get a guy who comes into this world with a particular vulnerability to stress. Let's say identical twins, one of which is inducted into military service, the other one is rejected for some physical limitation. The one who's inducted into military service is placed in a combat situation, and the stress is such that it exacerbates his vulnerability, and he's the one who develops psychological problems. The other guy had the same predisposition, but wasn't put in combat, so it never happened. The psychology of adjustment is where we are. Let's take a look at Freud's theory of anxiety. Moving right along. This is relatively straightforward. Freud tells us that his is, remember, a conflict model. He says conflict always leads to anxiety. He tells us there are three kinds of anxiety. Three types. Type number one, moral anxiety. Conflict over issues having to do with morality, right and wrong. Appropriate versus inappropriate, acceptable versus unacceptable, good and bad, legal and illegal. Freud says moral anxiety is the kind of anxiety that develops when there's conflict between the superego and the ego. Second type on your list, reality anxiety. Freud said reality anxiety is the kind of anxiety that we experience when there's conflict within the ego, over external sources of threat or potential danger or harm. Today, most people who were even of a psychoanalytic persuasion don't call that reality anxiety. They call it fear. Anxiety experienced in relationship to a known external source of threat or danger. Nothing in this world is going to teach you to climb trees faster than being chased by an angry pit bull. That's reality anxiety experienced in relationship to a known external source of threat or danger, whether it's real or imagined. Last one, neurotic anxiety. That's the one Freud knew the most about because that's what he dealt with every day in and day out with his patients. Neurotic anxiety, says Freud, is the kind of anxiety that we experience when there is conflict between the id and the ego over the loss of being able to control your impulses, to deal with the emotional discontrol, losing a handle on things, fearing that you just may lose control of yourself, your urges, your impulses, your passions, etc. Now, how do we deal with life's stresses and strains to prevent regression? Going back. Developing various types of adjustment or maladaptive or abnormal function. Bottom of the page, Roman numeral 5. What Freud called the ego defense mechanisms. Ways of thinking, feeling, or behaving that enable us to defend ourselves from threat, from anxiety, from debilitating conflict. Freud called them the ego defense mechanisms. I said early on when we were talking about the ego and the superego, I said these are techniques that the ego employs to defend and protect us from those things that would destabilize our personality, that would adversely affect our personality function. I'm just going to give you some general characteristics. By the way, this is not overkill. There are 25 of them. I'm holding you responsible for 12. The 12 most commonly used defense mechanisms. Freud tells us this, and this is a representative sample of the ones that are most commonly used by normal, healthy people, not the ones that are strictly limited to being used by abnormal persons, but normal, healthy persons. Freud says all of these are techniques of self-deception. He believed that there are always things about ourselves that we were unwilling to admit or acknowledge, things about ourselves that we didn't want to know. Techniques of self-deception. Ways of concealing things from ourselves, about ourselves. Number two, these ego defense mechanisms, according to Freud, are all employed unconsciously. We're not aware of them when we're using them. If we become consciously aware of it, then it's no longer useful as a defense mechanism. You can call it a coping strategy if you want to, but it's no longer effective in defending and protecting you from stress or anxiety because it's now a conscious thing you're doing rather than an unconscious, automatic, self-protective defensive technique. Next, Freud says that we are psychologically the healthiest when we employ a whole broad range of these. The more, the better. To employ a whole broad range of these ego defense mechanisms means that we're not going to overuse any one of them. Because here's what Freud tells us. The more we use a defense mechanism, the less effective it becomes. The less effective it becomes, the more we try to use it. The more we try to use it, the less effective it becomes. And now what we have is a downward, self-defeating spiral. But when we use a defense mechanism in combination with several others, it's less chance of them being overworked. So Freud believes that the defense mechanisms can be easily overused and worn out. Very often when we see somebody exhibiting the symptoms of abnormal psychological functioning, what other people describe as that person's symptoms are the outward visible manifestations of overused, overworked, worn-out defense mechanisms that they're using like crazy and still feeling incredibly stressed, still feeling incredibly anxious. So, Freud says, many of these we use in combination or in conjunction with one another. Last but not least, as a general characteristic, Freud says, the overuse of these defense mechanisms can be a very costly process. If we are constantly approaching life, situations, other people, events, things in our life, in a highly defensive, self-protective way, Freud says that requires a tremendous amount of psychological energy. Now, let me go back to the first thing that was on the first outline I gave, way back one, the one with the big print, the one that came with the pack of crayons. That first one says, Freud views us, human beings, as complex energy systems. We create the energy that we need to function. We take in stuff from the environment, we subject it to the processes of circulation, respiration, digestion, and we produce energy. First, physical energy. Energy we need in order to function in our daily activity. Freud says what we don't need for physical activity, we then convert from physical energy to psychological energy, or what he called psychic energy. And that's energy that we use for carrying out various psychological processes. Ah. Freud says if we as an individual are taking most of our psychological energy, and that's just what we have left over that we don't need for normal physical and physiological functioning, if we take most of that psychological energy and we are channeling it into the use of the defense mechanisms, that means, says Freud, there is very little energy we have left for constructive or productive purposes, for intellectual activity, for interpersonal activity, for emotional activity, for artistic activity. So Freud says that most human ineffectiveness, most human ineffectuality is the direct result of the excessive use of the defense mechanisms. So if we're channeling most of our psychological energy into the use of these defense mechanisms, that means we're a pretty ineffective person in our daily life, in our day-to-day activities, in the world of work, within the context of our relationships with other people. There's little energy that we have to give emotionally to that relationship. All of them are a refusal to see it. Yep, I'm going to go through each of them and show how it works.
Can, after these are exhausted, can they be recharged or brought, have, can the person be brought back to?
In Freud's view, no. Once it's gone, it's gone. He says the process of therapy, psychoanalysis is actually a process by which we attempt to take a person, eliminate those overworked, overused, worn-out defense mechanisms, and replace them with other, hopefully healthier defense mechanisms to replace the one. Because here's what the thinking is. If we're feeling incredibly stressed, there is a natural tendency for us to fall back on the three or four, maybe five defense mechanisms that in our past have proven to be most effective and useful to us. Those are the ones that get overused. Once they are overused, and they're right out there for everybody to see, then, says Freud, what we got to do is to take those and replace them with other ones that the person can use to defend and protect themselves, because now they're almost completely vulnerable to any kind of stress or threat or tension or conflict.
That done automatically? I mean, without thinking? Or
what's done without?
Does the person automatically start using these other...
No, this is what the process of therapy is.
Okay.
Helping people develop new ones.
Okay.
To suggest alternative ways in which they can cope with situations. Okay, what we have here are 12 defense mechanisms. Let me just make one final statement, then I'm going to let you go. Thursday, we're going to conclude this. Pencil me in on your dance card. Next Tuesday, you're going to have your next test. Dealing with Freud. The material in the various chapters, all the handouts that you've been presented with, and my lecture notes, all your lecture notes, dealing with psychoanalytic theory. That's a week from today. On Thursday, we're going to deal with these defense mechanisms. There are some that are presented in the book. There are others that you can look up. There are some I'm going to talk to you about and give them just a little bit different spin. Then maybe they're presented in other sources. But these are the 12 that are need-to-know defense mechanisms for the test next Tuesday. Anybody got any questions on what we talked about today before we move on? Yes.
The ego defense mechanism, what was your definition? Because
Ways of thinking, feeling, and behaving that we employ to defend and protect ourselves from threat, stress, and anxiety. In other words, Freud said, it's those defense mechanisms that prevent ego decompensation, prevent the ego from falling apart or succumbing to the overwhelming demands of either the id or the superego.
Hypothetical. What if one totally exhausts every single one? I mean, defense mechanism, they're just mentally insane or?
In the home. They come with the nets. They come with the restraints. And that's it.
Another question. If someone has fixations, and you probably answer this through therapy, they can. If someone has these fixations and the regressions back, and they go back and repair that, those stages?
That's the whole idea. Take it back to where it started and bring it forward in a healthier way than you did last time.
Through
psychoanalysis. That's it for today. We'll see you next time. Have a good day.
Deep.